He told to the actors, I don't want to see a tear. You know what I mean? It's not about crying. It's not about how much we are suffering. It's real pain inside. It's real loneliness. It's about going through life with all this, what that means when you grow up and you go through a lot of things, a lot of feelings and breakdowns and a lot of things that happen to us. Just to be alive, it means that. Also the way the camera moves, so elegant, but so discreet at the same time. So no one to catch the tension, all the solitude. Everything is so beautiful in this film. And it's true that for me, it's about this silence, this dangerous silence. And also has a lot to do with the feminine guiltiness of women. We are experts to feel guilty for everything.
The amazing Spanish actress Rosy de Palma. More from her soon. This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24, also ahead.
There's grit, there's dust, there's cicadas, there's how much do you want of the sound coming around you in the surrounds, how much do you want in the screen channel, how much sub's going to be used at any point.
You'd be surprised just how much work is involved with making even the most basic scene of a movie look like real life. We'll talk to some of the visual effects team at Goldcrest here in London. And a little later,
I feel I'm in the hands of a master craftsman. I'm like submerged in like the best painting ever. And I think that's what cinema can do.
Author and critic Jason Solomons reviews one of his favourite films, 1990's Goodfellas, in this week's Critics' Choice. That's all to come on The Cinema Show, right here on Monocle 24. Our show today takes us on a little trip, not just the geographic kind, but a trip through time, all the way back to Madrid of the 1980s. Hello and welcome to The Cinema Show. I'm Ben Rylan. Spain was still emerging from Franco's dictatorship when a young Rosy de Palma was a fixture of the city's club scene, performing as part of a 9-member band. Today, of course, Rosy is best known as the muse to legendary filmmaker Pedro Almodovar, and she appears yet again as a nasty old housekeeper in his latest wistful melodrama, Julieta. We'll hear from Rosy in a moment, but first, let's touch down in the Spanish capital for a tour of the city's film culture. David Bernal is a Madrid-born film writer. Here's his essay, originally published in Monocle's Travel Guide to Madrid, as performed by Monocle's Diego Fría.
In one of Pedro Almodóvar's first films, Labyrinth of Passion, 1982, the son of an emperor travels to Madrid and declares it the most fun city in the world. He wasn't wrong. At the time, the city was experiencing an explosion of creativity in the post-Franco era, known as La Movida Madrileña. The countercultural movement was a catharsis that marked the transition from old Madrid to the Madrid of today. But many of the older rituals in the film have not been lost. Waking early on a Sunday for El Rastro, a flea market in the old La Latina quarter that dates back to 1740. Then snacking on a calamari sandwich at one of the tabernas. Almodóvar is a director who has best portrayed Madrid's soul on film, and his work cannot be understood without taking into account the city's influence. In his films, Madrid is always a main character, sharing the big screen with the likes of Penélope Cruz, Antonio Banderas, Carmen Maura, and Victoria Abril. The drama What Have I Done to Deserve This, 1984, was set in one of the working class colmenas residences.
Iván? ¿Quién esperabas que llamara? Iván?
While comedy Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, 1988, was shot in a penthouse. Both films star Carmen Maura, but while the first is a neo-realist depiction of the city, the second opts for modern imagery. So which one is more accurate? Well, both. Madrid is a city of contrast, where everyone mixes together. At a party, you may rub shoulders with a duchess and a drag queen. This is its charm. The filmography of El Manchego, as Almodóvar is known, serves as a guide to some of the city's most beautiful corners. Characters from The Flower of My Secret, 1996, dance under the stars in the deserted Plaza Mayor. The Nurse in Talk to Her, 2002, watches silent films in the Cine Doré on Calle de Santa Isabel la Tercera, a cinema that houses a Spanish film archive. Almodóvar isn't the only one to use Madrid as a film set. Filmmakers of the 1990s no longer saw the city as a capital dominated by a dictator. Instead, they painted a cosmopolitan metropolis. These new films broke with tradition and embraced Hollywood genres. In The Day of the Beast, 1995, director Alex de la Iglesia set the arrival of the Antichrist atop the Torres Gio, a pair of skyscrapers in the financial district. The premise has some justification. Madrid is one of the only cities with a monument to Lucifer, standing tall in Retiro Park. Iglesias' picture includes one of the most iconic images in Spanish film, a priest and a metalhead hanging from the Schweppes sign crowning the Gran Vía skyline. 2 years later, Alejandro Amenábar, Spain's highest-grossing director, emptied the city's busiest boulevard to film a sequence in his thriller Open Your Eyes, 1997. Despite the city's modernity, a pure Madrid still exists. This Madrid castizo is caricatured in the Torrente saga, whose 5 installments star comedian Santiago Segura as an anti-hero, a scumbag cop, an Atletico fan who stresses and gentrifies streets and frequents bars with floors covered in prawn tails. American and French producers bought the rights for a remake, but such characters are usually lost in translation. Obviously, Madrid hasn't gone unnoticed in Hollywood. The Bourne Ultimatum, 2007, for example, includes scenes in Atocha's railway station and alongside the iconic Viaducto de la Calle Bailén. But the filmmaker who perhaps best took Madrid's pulse was Jim Jarmusch. The Limits of Control, 2009, shows the space-age architecture of the Torres Blancas residence, near Avenida de America, and actress Tilda Swinton meeting assassin Isaac de Bancolé in Plaza de Ildefonso, Malasaña. As it happens, this bohemian neighborhood is a perfect place to drink cañas and gather evidence for Madrid, quite possibly being the most fun city in the world.
An essay by the film writer David Bernal, originally published in Monocle's Travel Guide to Madrid, as performed there by Monocle's Diego Frio. David's writing has appeared in the Spanish newspaper El País, and he says his favourite Madrid set film is 1995's The Day of the Beast. You can pick up a copy of Our Madrid Guide now at all good booksellers or online over at monocle.com. Now, if anyone epitomizes Spain's unforced casual glamour, it must be Rossi de Palma. When I met Almodóvar's muse at a cinema here in London, it was quite literally like stepping into one of her films. I found her sitting in the center of the front row, dressed in leopard print, illuminated by a spotlight directly above her. Perfect. We started by discussing her early days with Almodóvar.
I arrived to Madrid from Mallorca, where I was born, with a band, a pop band, a music punk band we have at that time, called Worst Impossible. We dare to have this name. It's like an advertence to the people who want to come to see us, that if they don't like it, we already alarmed them that we were the worst impossible band. And we came to Madrid very fresh, very young people. I was 18 years old. And we have the chance to arrive in the last years of the last 80s. And with all this movida madrileña, the very known, call it movida madrileña, when the dictator Franco dies, and a lot of explosion of creativity and light and colors, and a lot of artists wanted to do things, express themselves. It was not about celebrity, it was not about money, be rich or whatever, not ambitious, nothing like that. It was more about let's express ourselves, let's deliver what we have inside, let's share art and creativity and joy and happiness, and let's invent things. That was the magical thing about the 80s. Very good music at that time too. Very amazing clothes that we can make by ourselves, and ingenious things. A lot of things going on. And then Pedro was already very known in the underground, and because he has already turned Dark Habits, about the nuns who takes drugs, and this very funny and interesting film. And then he was preparing Matador, and he came sometimes to see us, our performance with my band. We were in the same ambience in the night, in the same clubs. And my band was like 9 people. We were a lot of people. And we became friends, and we met in the same places. And I wanted to go to Matador. When he prepares Matador, I wanted to go to the casting to present myself like there. I want to be in your film, because I don't wanted to ask him directly. I was very respectful. I said to myself, I'm going to seduce him from distance. At that time, I remember me thinking about that, because everybody was already too much into him. Ah, Madara, ah. Everybody was in the night, in the clubs. Ah, Madara. And I was like, no, I don't want to be heavy like them. I want to seduce him.
That cool air of distance was just part of what set Rossi apart from the crowd of people all vying for Almodovar's attention. This was 1980s Madrid. They were the trendiest pair in town.
And then Pedro used to come in there. It was a bar who called it King Creole. It was a little rockabilly. At that time, he was wearing a toupee, like the rockabilly. It was a little bit like that. It changed always a lot, but at that time was that mood, and also very sexy. I was like 18 years old. I was a very beautiful body, very young. And once Pedro came with his costume designers, and he was preparing The Law of Desire, as Carmen Maura was playing the transsexual. They saw my dress, and they asked me, where we can find this kind of dress so sexy like that? This I made it myself. I don't know. What about your earrings? I made it myself too. Indeed, in The Law of Desire, Carmen Maura wears a lot of earrings I made that time. And even she keep one of them. The other day I met her and said, I still have in your earrings. And then Pedro asked me, do you like to come to make a little role in my next film? I would like to have you.
That's, of course, when Rossi's star began to rise. The self-described ugly duckling slipped right into her stride in the colourful, soapy world created by Almodovar.
Pedro said to the makeup artist, don't make up her, because she's going to make up by herself. To the hair stylist, don't do nothing. I want her, she do her own hair. To the costume designer, she's going to wear her own clothes. And what you see in The Law of Desire is me at that moment, at that time. He wanted what he uses to see in me, that plastique.
Now here's a word of warning to you. If you happen to find yourself in a restaurant somewhere in Madrid and you spot Rossi de Palma, which is usually fairly easy to do, she tends to stand out in the best possible way, I'd advise against ordering the gazpacho, even if you've seen 1989's Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
I drank that gazpacho with pills. That was the gazpacho I drank in Women on the Verge, was with pills to sleep. And I sleep. And it was very boring in the film because I was too much days sleeping. And they said, tomorrow you had to come because the camera going to move like that. They're going to see your legs. They're going to see your body lying in the hammock. We want to see you and come here. And I had to come to sleep. Yes, What kind of work of an actress is that? Going to sleep all the day. I was fed up, and I was always telling to Pedro, Pedro, please, I'm fed up of sleeping. What is my character supposed to do? And Pedro, what do you want to do, people, when they sleep? You take a gazpacho with drugs, you fall asleep. What you can do with people when they sleep, asleep? And I say, yes, but I get bored. And then one day he came. I was so heavy, asking some action. And then one day he came and said to me, listen, you're going to have a dream in your sleep. And then you're going to have an orgasm in your dream. And you're going to stop to be virgin in the dream. And I say, okay, let's have some action. Even if I'm sleeping or dreaming, whatever, I take it.
How did you then grasp the craft of acting as well? Had that always been something that you were very passionate about and that you could envision yourself becoming?
I'm an artist. Since I was very little girl, I began with the poetry, with something. I knew that was where I was living was not a particular any relation with art or even entertainment or nothing. But I knew inside me that something was waiting for me, that there was another kind of world, another universe, and somebody, like, you know, like the ugly duck, you know, that is not your ambience, but you're going to find your ambience later, no? And I think I began to be an actress when I was a little girl, because I began to understand that when each person was reading something different, and I was not acting, but almost with, I was searching for myself, but at the same time, I knew how to become another one. It depends on the situation. It depends on the people you are with.
The wonderful Rossi De Palma. She's part of the cast of Pedro Almodovar's latest film, Julieta, which is just wonderful and out in theatres today. This is The Cinema Show. More to come in a moment. Next week on The Cinema Show, it's all about the musical. From The Wizard of Oz to Chicago, we raise the curtain on a special musically themed edition. Plus, we'll set sail for Venice as the world's oldest film festival gets underway. That's next week on The Cinema Show.
The Report Card, brought to you by The Cinema Show. $88 million Australian dollars. That's how much Village Roadshow's earnings have been boosted by its theme parks throughout Australia, Asia, and Las Vegas. The company behind one of Australia's largest cinema chains also operates Warner Brothers Movie World on the Gold Coast and the water park Wet n Wild in Sydney, though attendance there dropped by about 100,000 people due to some unseasonably wet weather. $24 million US dollars. That's how much has been injected into Norway's economy following the introduction of incentives to attract international film productions. The country's finances have taken a battering following a drop in oil prices and the loss of about 100,000 jobs. The managing director of Norway's Film Institute told Variety that the country's cinemas turn over about $145 million every year. But the incentive scheme is only 10 months old. The Institute says it's still determining its effect on the wider industry. $10 million US dollars, that's how much Amazon paid for the drama Manchester by the Sea at this year's Sundance Film Festival. The film stars Michelle Williams and Casey Affleck, who plays the uncle to a 16-year-old nephew dealing with tensions from the past that arise following his brother's death. The first trailer has just been released, with a theatrical run expected to begin on the 18th of November.
You're tuned to The Cinema Show here on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. If you wanted to give your film a natural, untouched look, you'd probably just apply as little editing as possible, right? Well, no, it doesn't really work that way. See, even films aiming for gritty realism still need to look a certain way. We've just come to expect it when we go to the cinema. Skin tones are adjusted. Lighting often needs correcting. A wrinkle or two might even be removed. The team at Goldcrest Post-Production over in London's Soho recently wrapped work on the Jason Bourne film. I popped in for a look at their massive underground facility.
The role of a digital colourist, basically, is to sit down with the cinematographer and director and deliver what they want on the big screen by just relighting the picture, changing colours, making day-night. My name's Rob Pitsey, and I'm a digital colourist at Goldcrest Films.
We do the final mixes and pre-mixing of the sound for the film, really. So from our point of view, the sound editors have all spent 3 months editing and pre-mixing. They get to our point, and then the mixers balance the dialogues, music, effects, and all those elements to make up those bits together to give the director what they want and make it sound theatrical. I'm Rob Weatherall. I'm studio manager for the three dubbing theatres.
On Bourne, it was very naturalistic, gritty look, so we nailed that straight away. We knew exactly how Paul Greengrass and Barry Aykroyd, the cinematographer, how they wanted the film to look, almost lo-fi. But also, you know, within those scenes, they've got their own distinct look. Athens is warm, Berlin is slightly cooler, but it's still gritty. On a film, say, Kingsman, it's a little bit more glossy, a bit richer. You discuss with the director and cinematographer very early on.
Bourne is, it's an action-packed, loud, impressive film. But at the same time, if you listen to the level of detail, like all the way through the film, I mean, the music as well is quite big and driving. So for the effects to get through, that whole kind of storytelling balance between the dialogues, music and effects. And there isn't too much dialogue in this film, for example, from Jason Bourne himself. So most of his kind of storytelling, certainly to back up the picture of a much older, more solemn, and if you listen to the sound, I mean, it's phenomenal, like the gunshots, every gunshot, car screech, door playing, punch. I mean, every punch will be made up of 6 or 7 punches elements and then designed around to give a certain feel. It's not just a thing of, oh, there's someone walking along and they punch someone in the head. We'll do a sound effects, 4 footsteps and a punch. There's grit, there's dust, there's cicadas, there's how much do you want of the sound coming around you and the surrounds, how much do you want in the screen channel, how much sub's going to be used at any point. All those decisions are kind of made in the final mix after about 3 to 4 months of work of people sat in dark cutting rooms, cutting together all the elements that are going to make those sounds.
Are you removed from the filmmaking process because of the reality of your jobs?
It has to be a good story. From a sound point of view, from someone who sits in mix theatres for up to 70 hours a week listening to people mix 3-second loops of stuff, when I watch a film that's well mixed and it has a good story, I don't think about the sound and my job doesn't get related. As soon as a story isn't ideal and the sound isn't perfect, then you kick into work mode and you start critiquing. I honestly think if it's a good story and it's well acted, you'll forgive many things because
they've got to be pretty bad, haven't they?
Yeah.
But we have seen a few dodgy ones. And it does take you out of the film. You're like, oh my God, what's that? That's shocking.
Yeah.
I can recall watching a few older films where they've perhaps tried to do that whole shooting during the day and then making it look like night, but perhaps before technology had quite caught up. So often it looks like they've just put a piece of blue cellophane in front of the camera.
Some of those look so, like the 1940s, 1950s sort of films, and they did that. They've got a great look. It's just different.
It's the headlamps, isn't it?
It's just different, You know, it's just a different feel. There's something quite sort of quirky about it. I don't mind it. I was watching an old film the other day and I saw it and there's something quite magical about it, you know.
The room we're in right now kind of just looks like a theatre. I mean, it looks like exactly like a cinema, except it has a big, I suppose you could describe it as a bat computer right at the back there. So, I mean, you spend a lot of your time in a cinematic setting, both of you. So how is it when you then decide to, you know, maybe some of your friends say, let's go and see a movie for enjoyment. Do you just think, I don't want to go and see a movie. I spend most of my time in these dark cinemas.
I don't know for you, for a sound point of view, I love going to the cinema. It's great because from our point of view, especially as a facility, as soon as that theatre stops running and something breaks, it's kind of your responsibility to get up and going again. If I go to the cinema, I don't have to worry about the projector breaking, the speakers breaking, someone else pressing play. If it's in sync or any of that, I can sit back and watch a film. I love it. Because it's kind of like a busman's holiday, I guess, but not having to drive the bus because you kind of just completely can watch a film for what it is and not have that slight stress of, is everything working okay? I don't know, from your point of view, it's probably...
When I'm grading a film, I spend some long hours in here. I literally, especially in the winter, you get up, it's dark, come into work, it's dark, work, in the dark, go home, in the dark. So during the winter months, probably would go less to the cinema. I should go more, but I love, you know, like what Rob says, I love going to the cinema and sitting down and just enjoying a film and not worrying about having to grade it.
Rob Pitsey and Rob Weatherall there from Goldcrest Post Production here in London. And finally today, it is time for this week's Critics' Choice. Now, regular Monocle 24 listeners will be familiar with our friend Jason Solomons. Among many ventures, he recently released a book chronicling Woody Allen's entire career on the screen, film by film. When I asked him to choose a movie for this week's show, however, he surprised me. He didn't pick a Woody Allen film. Instead, he chose Martin Scorsese's 1990 gangster film, Goodfellas.
Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas is a film that I come back to repeatedly. It's the sort of film I can put on like a favourite album. It's got so many great songs in it anyway. It's like an American songbook, and it uses the American songbook to tell the story of gangster life from the 50s all the way through with this character played by Ray Liotta.
As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster.
And he becomes part of this gangster gang with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci, led by Paul Sorvino's Paulie. And it's all about that kind of life, that emotional and physical life lived as a gangster until one day he turns tails. Based on a true story, of course, by Nick Pialeggi, it shows you all life in a way, because he has a love affair with Karen, beautifully played, and she's kind of a Jewish girl and he's obviously a kind of an Italian-American. In its gangster way, it kind of looks at the history of America in a very small, violent way. Again, the dialogue is always terrific, with Joe Pesci doing some of the finest, kind of most Scorsese-ish of moments, where you never know what funny how. You're like, I amuse you like I'm a clown. Is this funny? Yes, that is very, very funny, but you're on a knife edge of danger all the way through. The violence is extraordinary always, but it is a story of violence, and it's sort of about the history of violence throughout the US. The final sequences, which have Ray Liotta kind of, you know, cocained out of his head, paranoid to the max, trying to make sauce and do the cooking, but while the FBI are flying overhead in planes.
I told my brother to keep an eye on the stove. All day long, the poor guy's been watching helicopters and tomato sauce.
Don't let Karen touch the sauce.
You see, I had to drive over to Sandy's place, mix the stuff once, and then get back to the gravy.
It is absolutely brilliant. Goodfellas is, for me, a massive towering achievement of cinema. If I see one frame of it late night on Channel 5 at 2 in the morning, I have to watch all of it, and I'm there till 4:30. I cannot take my eyes off Goodfellas. I think it's an extraordinary piece. I mean, it's got one of my favourite sequences of all time, one of the great craft-making sequences of cinema, the travelling shot by the cinematographer Michael Bauhaus, where he follows Ray Liotta and Lorraine Bracco and they go for their night out to the club, and they go through the kitchens and they follow all the way through the kitchens, and they suddenly arrive at their best table in the house right at the front of the stage. She says,
what do you do?
What
do you do?
I'm in construction.
It's a brilliant travelling shot with a great punchline. And so the filmmaking craft in Goodfellas is just to die for. You watch it and you just think, this is a master at work. The characters are hugely strong. The dialogue is brilliant. But ultimately, I'm lost in this kind of creation of this world by Scorsese, which is perfect, from the costumes that Robert De Niro wears, to the hair, to the dialogue, to the authenticity of the swearing, which is key to it. I feel I'm in the hands of a master craftsman. I'm like submerged in like the best painting ever. And I think that's what cinema can do. Scorsese in Goodfellas is at the height of his powers.
Film critic Jason Solomons there. And that's it for today. Next week, we're all about the musical.
Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town? And all that jazz, I'm gonna rouge my knees and roll my stockings down.
That's next week, when a special triple musical bill kicks off on Mubi, and we set sail for Venice. And if you haven't yet tried Mubi, well, now's the time. You can get a whole month of carefully curated cult and classic films for free. Head over to mubi.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Today's show was edited by Claire Crofton and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on your favourite podcast app and leave us a review as well. The Cinema Show is back next week. I'm Ben Ryland. Thanks for listening.